So I decided that I would organize it more along methods or the structure of the theory rather than the phenomenology of the standard model. For one part, there's not really enough time in 3 weeks for me to go over the breadth of the phenomenology of particle physics that the standard model is used for. So I think focusing on methods or features of the theory and then throwing in the phenomenology to illustrate its most important uses is the best way to go. So that's how I decided to organize things. So here we go. So the first week, roughly the first week, would be the standard model, that standard model at tree level. So that's basically the Lagrangian. What are the parameters that characterize the interactions in the Lagrangian? And you know, how you calculate things, we'll have to say a little bit about things like gauge fixing. And in some sense, this is the most important part of the course, because once you have the general philosophy of what the standard model is and you write out the Lagrangian, you know, in principle, you're done, right? It's Miller time. You can calculate everything if you're strong enough. Of course, that's not how things work in the real world. Some things you can compute, some things are too hard to compute, some things the computations involve a certain amount of lore. You can't really prove it goes this way, but you know it goes this way. So we have to go a little forward from that. And so the next section will be the standard model at one loop and beyond. Yeah. And so this will be things like, we'll have to say a little bit about renormalization. I'll talk about asymptotic freedom. And I'll talk about the parton model. And you know, one of my goals for the type of phenomenology that I'm going to talk about is for you to be able to calculate all the properties of the Higgs. So we're going to calculate the production rate of the Higgs at the LHC. We're going to calculate the various branching ratios to modes. And so that's sort of the theme that I'm going to use to illustrate all the methods here. So for asymptotic freedom, for example, we'll calculate the production rate. PP goes to Higgs plus anything. Usually you call anything X. I'm not sure how anything ended up X and not Y, but it ended up X. And then for the last section, yeah, I could just stop lecturing at some point and spend 40 minutes playing with the boards. But we'll try to avoid that. So the final section will be what I would call low energy methods. So sort of a collection of methods, and I'll illustrate them with the appropriate phenomenology, that are used to do lower energy physics. So what are these type of methods? There's one that's called chiral perturbation theory, which is used to do the physics of pions, kaons, nucleon interactions with pions and kaons at low energies. There's effective Hamiltonians, where you integrate out degrees of freedom in the standard model that are heavy and not relevant for the not really relevant for the problem you're interested in the sense that they're too heavy to be produced in the phenomenology you're trying to study. And so effective Hamiltonians basically lets you write interactions just in terms of the relevant degrees of freedom for the problem. Simplifies things. Sometimes you don't know the full theory if you're, if you have new physics that is not explained, and then you usually start with effective Hamiltonians to describe that phenomenology and build up the whole theory from that. For example, in the standard model, we have the standard model now, but Fermi had 4 Fermi interactions before we understood the standard model. And then I don't think I'll get to it, but I'd like to say something about heavy quark physics and the methods there. I might get to it because, you know, that's something that I was involved with developing. So it's kind of nice to talk about your own stuff at some point, but we'll see. So that's the general outline of the stuff I hope to cover. this lecture today is basically, it's a lecture for us to get used to each other. So I'm going to go over some stuff that you probably know, set some conventions like cross-sections, decay rates, and then tomorrow morning, bright and early, I'm on the West Coast, so this seems like absurd to be lecturing at 6 a.m., but anyways, I'll get used to it. Okay, so you should actually tell me, well, I'll ask you as I go along, you know, whether any of it's not familiar for you, just so I can gauge, you know, what you know, what you're comfortable with as we go forward. So in particle physics, usually you talk about cross sections and decay rates. And that's forced upon us. There's a lot more to physics than cross sections and decay rates, of course. You take condensed matter physics, they talk about a lot of other stuff. But in high energy physics, it's mostly cross sections and decay rates for decay rates for unstable particles. It's kind of a funny name, because if it's unstable, it's not a particle, it's a resonance. But we call them particles anyways. And almost all the particles in particle physics are unstable, right? Even the neutron decays if it's a free neutron. Luckily, if it's bound, it doesn't decay. Otherwise, it would be awful. We wouldn't exist. That would be bad. But anyways, bound neutrons are stable. But more or less, the other particles we talk about, the W, the Z, the Higgs, the bottom quark, the top quark, they're all unstable particles or resonances. And so we want to know their decay rates, which determine their lifetime. And we also want to know the decay rates to particular modes, sometimes called partial rates, because those determine the fraction of the time that the particle will decay to a given final state. So that's why we look at decay rates. We look at cross sections because, in addition to the name particle physics, it's called high energy physics. And we got to go to high energies because, you know, that's the way we can make particles with a very heavy mass, right? We have to get enough kinetic energy to convert that into mass energy. That's done at these big accelerators. And if you want to calculate the rates for certain production of certain particles, then you need to know the cross section. Multiply the cross section times the incident flux, and you get the rate. So a cross section means the same thing as it does in classical physics. Because it's kind of a peculiar thing. I don't know, you've probably found this out already, that if you want to calculate a cross section in classical physics, it's easier to do it in quantum mechanics. I never really understood why precisely, but that ends up being true. But same thing, same idea. Easier to understand in quantum mechanics. Okay, so this lecture I'm basically going to go over how you calculate cross sections and decay rates, just a mini review and some phenomenology. And if I talked away, okay, let's just go on. So that's what I'm going to do this lecture. So what should I start with? Well, so let me start with how we're going to do phase space. The cross sections calculated usually involve some integration or the decay rates over all the possible three momenta of the final state particles. And so that's called phase space. And that phase space is usually written in this Lorentz invariant form. So if there's n particles with momenta p1, to Pn, then phase space there's different sort of conventions for how you write the phase space depending on how you normalize the states. Let me tell you how I'm normalizing the states. I'm normalizing them like this. Oops. This is an inner product between the states. It's P1 and, well, actually, I don't need the 1 here. just could call it P, to the energy of the state times 2 pi cubed times a delta function that sets the momentum equal to. That's how I normalize states, and that's part of the origin of these energy factors in the denominator, because I put the energies there. And some people put the overall delta function in the phase space. So, you know, I'll leave that up to you whether you call this part of the phase space. But when you calculate any rate or cross section, of course, there's some. Let me not leave it out because I have to say something about the initial state for that. Okay. So let's say I want to calculate a decay rate. We got a particle, we'll call it A. It's got a certain momenta, PA. And the rest frame is just the mass of the particle and zero momenta. You'd have to be a raving lunatic to calculate a decay rate in any other frame. We're going to try to avoid being raving lunatics. So we calculate the decay rate, we'll stick in the rest frame. So how do I calculate? Oh, I should have said one more thing. In the phase space, if there's n identical particles, then you get a 1 over n factorial. When I did the inner product for the normalization of states, if they have spin, then you have to label the states by a spin as well. And there's a Kronecker delta so that they have the same spins. So, but you put those factors in. It's okay. So what's the decay rate for particle A to decay, let's say, to particles 1 to n? It's 1 over twice the mass of the decaying particle. That's times the integral over the phase space. And then if you're doing an average decay rate, you average over initial spins. You sum over final spins. And then there's the matrix element. M, the quantum mechanical amplitude for this process to occur. You take its absolute value squared because we're doing quantum mechanics. We're calculating probabilities. And then you conserve momenta. Energy and momenta. So that's how you calculate a decay rate. If you want to know the fraction of the time that a particle, on average, decays to a given final state, that's called the branching ratio. So the branching ratio for particle A to go to a particular final state, F, is given by this decay rate, gamma A to F, given by the total decay rate, gamma total, where gamma total, oopsie, that doesn't look like a gamma, does it? Is the sum over all final states of gamma A to F. Oh, I have to say, throughout this class, I'm going to use units where H bar equals C equals 1. So if you have a time, it's like 1 over an energy. A length is 1 over an energy. A momentum is the same as an energy. Most of the time, the units I'll use will be GeV. And if you want to think about what that is, the mass of the proton converted into energy is about a GeV. So it's kind of a convenient unit to think about in particle physics. If you go to some other fields of high energy physics, they'll also set Newton's constant to 1. I can't do that. Drives me nuts. Just like this drives you nuts the first time you do it, but it's really just a choice of units. You can measure your time in a suitable unit so and other things so that these are equal to 1. But you have to put them back in their real values when you want to get a real number, like a decay rate in or a lifetime in seconds, for example. But you always know how to put them in just by dimensional analysis. So the lifetime is given by 1 over gamma total. Okay. So let's just do a little example. Let's use this. Everybody seen this before? It's supposed to be review-ish. No? Don't fear. I'm going to do it all anyways. That's why I'm doing it, to get a feeling for what you know. It's okay. Okay, so let's do a little example so you know how to do this. Let's imagine that there's only two particles in the final state. I'm going to confess something to you. So here I did it in general. I have this fancy pants N. So I have calculated an extremely large number of branching ratios and decay rates in my lifetime. I won't tell you how long that is. But anyways, I calculated a lot. 96% of them are two-body. The other 4% I calculated were three-body. I'm afraid to do four-body. So once you know two-body, you're more or less good to go. And I'll do a three-body for you a little bit later. And then if you have to do four-body, you're on your own. Can't help you there, since I haven't really done one. Okay, so two-body final state. So this is A, it goes to 1, 2, just two particles. So let's imagine the particles have no spin. We'll talk about spin later on. Let's imagine they have no spin, and therefore they're just labeled by whatever their three momentum is, and then their energy, the fourth component of the four momentum, or the zero component, depending on how you label things, is just, you know, the square root of p squared plus m squared. It's fixed. So what could the matrix element m depend on? It ends up that m is Lorentz invariant, the way I've defined things. And so it's got to depend on Lorentz invariants. What are the only Lorentz invariants I can form? Question. You're not used to questions, right? Let me get rid of this. I'll show you how the questions work, although I got to go to the bank. For 25 cents. Don't spend it all in one. It's really for humor value, not for the value of the money. But anyway, it's for 25 cents. It's a Lorentz invariant, and what can it depend on for this problem? If this is a fancy pants quarter, it's got this little red maple leaf in it. I'm from the States. We don't even consider this money when you start putting stuff like that. Well, that's what it ends up being, but it's not what I wanted. But still, just to get things started, I'm going to give you this quarter. Do it like charity. Well, it's actually the right answer, so you skip a step. So that's how it works. So, you know, it could depend on dot products of the momenta. Right? They're four vector dot products. They're scalars, and those are the only scalars around because there's no other variable relevant to the problem, no spins, for example, and so that's all it can depend on. But we have energy momentum conservation, and so we know, for example, that Pa squared is Ma squared, look at this, Pj squared. Is mj squared. Unfortunately, j just goes over 1 and 2, so it's not so fancy. And then if you want something like p1 dot p2, that's another thing you could form. You write that as a half p1 plus p2 squared minus m1 squared over 2. Hold on a second. What board am I on, the middle board? Minus m2 squared over 2. And so that takes care of the squares and just leaves you with the dot product. And so this is a half ma squared. So you're right. That's why I got the quarter. In the end, it just depends on the masses. All the dot products are determined by the masses. And so if I want to calculate the decay right here, this is just a number. It's just a function of the masses. This is 1 because I assume there were no spins. So I just factor it out, and I got to do an integral. Is that clear to everybody? You with me? You sure? Well, if you're not, come see me in the afternoon. You get like 5 minutes off in the day, right? Well, I'll be sitting in my office. Should I make office hours, or what am I going to do? I got nothing to do anyways. I'm going to be in my office every afternoon between 2 and 6. Then I'm going to be downstairs eating. You can catch me there, too. Ask the questions. Don't be shy. Okay, so we got to do the phase space. We got to do this integral. We factored out the m squared.
Excuse me?
Yes?
We said that the masses, the momenta are the quantities that m might depend on. Why is it that we go to dot products immediately?
Because it's a Lorentz scalar. So the momenta, they're four momenta, they transform like four vectors. I didn't derive this for you, but the matrix element M, the way I've defined it, is a scalar under Lorentz transformations. So if you want to make something that's a scalar, doesn't transform, the way, and you only have four vectors, you have to take dot products of those four vectors to get a Lorentz scalar. And so all you've got are dot products of those four vectors, and then because of energy momentum conservation, you can express those in terms of the masses. Is that okay? Good to ask questions. Okay, so here we go. So now I have to write it out explicitly. I'm a lot slower than I thought. It's okay. I'll get better at it as time goes on. Guess what you do next? You use a trick. That's what you do in physics. You use a trick. Every third step is a trick. Yeah. Use the following trick. So if I have D3P1 over 2E1, that's the same as D4P1. Oh, let me make sure I actually got rid of P1 and not P2 in the end. Oh, geez Louise, I got rid of P2. So this is the four vector dot product, E2 squared minus P2 vector squared. And the way you show this is you just do the P2 naught, the energy integral here, and you just use the usual formulas for a delta function, you know, 1 over the derivative, which makes the 2 P0, evaluating it at the location, and that gives you this formula. So how many people have seen this before? How many people feel confident they could derive it, given what I said? You explicitly do the P0 integration, use the usual formula for the delta function. Try it today in the vast amount of spare time that you have, and if it doesn't work out, you come to my office, and I do it explicitly, and I fix you. Yes?
Just a question. Don't you need step function or something like that?
Yeah, it's a theta of P2 naught. But I never bothered to write that down. Yeah, that's correct. Because there's two roots. Yeah, one negative, one positive. But we always take the right root, positive energy. OK, so let's go ahead and use that. So we'll write the D3P2 like that. This D4P2, we'll do that with this delta function. 2 pi to the 6, 2 pi to the 4th, 1 over 2 pi squared, yada, yada, yada. From the 4 vector, oh, look at this, I'm caught. From the 4 vector delta function, okay? Okay. So let's be very explicit. So what do I got? I got PA squared, that's MA squared, and there'll be a P1 squared, that's M1 squared, minus M2 squared, that's minus m2 squared, and there's minus 2pa dot p1, which is ma e1. So what do I want to do? I want to do part of this integral with the delta function. So remember that p1 is the square root of e1 squared minus m1 squared. And so dp1 is dE1 divided by the square root. And so that implies that p1 dp1 is equal to e1 dE1. I just bring this back over to the other side, and I got p1. So I can trivial. You're never supposed to use the word trivial when you're lecturing, unless you're getting into trouble and you have to disarm the student body. But I'm not in trouble yet, so I apologize for the T word. Everybody with me? Okay, so I get 1 over 2 pi, I get an integral, so there's an integral over the direction of p1, I'll call that the omega, 1, the direction of the three momenta, and then there's p1 squared dp1, which I'll convert the one of the p1s to e1 dE1, and the e1 in the numerator cancel the e1 in the denominator, yada, 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 and we get P1, dE1. Jeez, my notes are wrong. I suck. Anyways, that's a delta function. So now we're done, right? You do the E1 integration with the delta function, and we can get the final formula. I can't do every step for you. If I do every step, I'll run out of time. But I just want to get it down to a place where it's a very simple algebra. Okay, so that's our formula. We get that d gamma d omega 1, differential decay rate, is equal to, if you do the final step, and I did, let's assume I did it right here. Probably some of the things I write on the board will be wrong because I'm just sort of making up the lectures as I go. So this is a part. This is a differential decay rate. It's the probability. It gives you a probability where now you've said that. Yes.
Do you want to square it on the m2, all the way on the right?
Yes. Thank you.
And also, sorry, but what is the connection between what you're writing on the new board and what we just finished?
So this is gamma here when I put in the matrix element square. So I'm trying to get, let's see. So, hey, maybe I never wrote that.
It's underneath.
So I'm trying to compute gamma, this thing here. So I'm doing, this was just a constant, so I factored it out. And I'm doing the integrals in the phase space here. So I told you how to do the integrals, and now I'm putting it all together. The only thing that's a little tricky is I didn't get the total. I was about to explain this. I don't have the total gamma here. I have this sort of differentiated gamma, d gamma d omega 1. But this is so the total decay rate is a probability where particle 1 could, it's, if I look at its momentum as I go towards a sphere at infinity, it can be pointing in any direction or in any little element of solid angle. Here's the all-seeing eye. And the particle's momenta from here's the particle at decay, with a little solid angle, d omega. The all-seeing eye has an infinitesimal solid angle. And so I'm calculating the probability here by this differential. If I multiply by d omega 1, this side, it's the probability that it decays, but and particle 1 ends up going into this solid angle. If I want the total decay rate, I just integrate this in the end over all solid angles omega. Got it? Okay. In this case, does m depend on the solid angle? Don't let me down, class. Be bold. Yell it out. Say it. Oh, geez, you're holding out for cash now. That's what happens when you... what happens when you... Do I have any money left? Oh, no, I've only got one of these large coins. It's like a dollar. No, here's another quarter. Okay. Does M depend on the solid angle? Okay, who said no? It came from back there first. Look at there's cash on the line. Claim your quarter. I haven't got time for this.
I said no.
That's right. It doesn't even matter, you see? You should take credit. Yeah, okay. Of course, it doesn't depend on the solid angle. We just said we could express it in terms of the masses. No solid angle. And so you can trivially do the integral. You just get a factor of 4 pi. Okay? That's decay rates, cross sections. Oh, geez, I'm abysmally slow. So now we imagine we're doing a scattering experiment. It's kind of like this. Particles come in, A, B. Let's say we're working in the center of mass. Usually, we're only going to think about the center of mass in the lab frame. The lab frame would be where particle B is at rest, and A comes in and hits it. And the center of mass frame is where the total three momentum initially is zero, so they're coming in head on. And then, boom. You like that video effect? Say it one more time. Boom! They collide, out comes stuff. Some of the stuff ends up in the all-seeing eye, and you want to calculate the probability for that, but the probability is proportional to the incident flux, the number of particles. Let's say we were in the lab frame, so B was at rest, then it's the flux of incident particles A. So we divide by that, and we form something called the cross-section, which gives us the rate for particles that go into that solid angle. So I'm presuming you know how to take a cross-section, multiply by the flux, and get a rate. But I can give a problem or two on that if you've never seen that. So we got D phase space, and then we got an invariant matrix element that gets squared, and then we got 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 that conserves energy and momentum. And that'll give you the cross section for a process which you would usually write as this: A and B collide to make 1 plus N. And we're doing high energies, high energy physics, because we want to make heavy particles, particles that aren't around in everyday life, things that are unstable. We only can make them in these accelerators. Actually, you can make them in the early universe, the very early universe, but it's high. You'd be uncomfortable. So in practice, they're just made in the laboratory with these high energy accelerators. Unfortunately, we've gotten to such high energies that these accelerators cost tens of billions of dollars. So unless there's some brilliant new technology that comes on, we're sort of hitting the end of the road for big accelerators. Yes, sir?
Can we make them in, say, supernovae?
You could make some in supernova. It depends on the energy of the process allowed that occurs, and it also was a lot of energy in a supernova. But you know, if you want to produce a particle, you need a local interaction. So if the energy total production is dispersed over a larger volume, it doesn't typically go into producing very massive particles, but rather a lot of lower mass particles. So it's not just energy. The interactions in the theory are local. You have to concentrate that energy into some basic collision that occurs at very high energy between constituents. So, okay. So we got to calculate a cross section. Yeah?
So in the previous part, you are calculating the decay rate.
Mm-hmm.
Here you calculate the
cross section.
So,
two different.
What is the same thing and different thing?
Okay, so it's two different types of experiments.
So
So experiment one for which you want decay rates. Somehow you manage to make this unstable particle. It's sitting there in a bottle. Of course, it only lives 10 to the minus 12 seconds, so you've got to be fast, the bottle. But anyways, it's sitting there, and you want to know how long it'll be before it disappears into other things. It's an unstable particle. So for that, you need to calculate its total decay rate, gamma total, and that time, its average lifetime, tau, is given by 1 over gamma total. If you want to know the fraction of time it goes to a particular final state, for example, a particle might, say a particle that contains a heavy B quark and a light anti-quark is called a B meson. And a B meson could go to a D meson. We replace this by a charm plus an electron or an antineutrino. This has got spin zero. It could go to the analog with spin one, electron antineutrino. You want to know the relative, the fraction of time it goes to this versus this. What you've got to calculate is the branching ratio for A to those particular final states. So that's what this is used for. Here you assume you've got your unstable particle and you want to understand the final states it can occur, it can decay to, the fraction of time to each final state, and you want to know the total lifetime of the particle. Is that clear? What about this one? Okay, so this one here is a cross section. So you've got some accelerator. Let's just do a topical example. You've got two beams of protons. You're bashing them into each other. So the basic process is proton plus proton. Let's say you've got a very high energy accelerator at 8,000 GeV. So the center of mass energy, if we work in the center of mass, the sum of these two energies, the two protons, is 8,000 times the proton mass. You need a mighty big machine to do that. And then you want to know, okay, when you collide them, you've got a lot of energy. You could make heavy things. Anything with a mass less than this, in principle, you could make with energy conservation, because you can convert the kinetic energy of the protons into rest mass energy. Einstein, E equals mc squared. It's the only formula my 90-year-old mother knows. Actually, she doesn't know that formula. But anyway, she knows a lot of other things. So why do we want to do this? Well, we want to make something like the Higgs boson plus other stuff, x. And we want to know the probability or the number of Higgs bosons that we'll make for a given incident flux of protons. How you get that is you calculate the cross-section for this process and multiply it by the flux at your accelerator to get the number of Higgs's you make. So cross-sections to calculate the production rates of various particles like the Higgs. This could be a Z. I could ask for the rate for two Higgs. It's up to me. And X means I sum over all other things. But that's what you're going to do with a proton. You're always going to sum over. Yes?
So
I could derive it for you, but it takes like 3/4 of a lecture. So, it's a question of me trying to understand what was done in field theory. So how many people would like me to derive the cross-section formula?
We've done it before.
Yeah. Okay. I had assumed you had done it before. So you could look it up, if, for example, in a book like Peskin and Schroeder, they'll have a section where they derive the formula for the cross section. If you have trouble with that, you can come see me. We can go through it. Usually, to derive it right is incredibly hard. I've never derived it right. To derive it really right, you've got to use wave packets, and it's like some kind of nightmare. It's a hellish experience. So I always use plain waves, and then you've got to finesse a few things. More questions? Okay.
So back to your comments about the type of interactions in supernovae, how do we know that local interactions dominate over long-range interactions, for instance?
Well, when you write your Lagrangian, it's all got local interactions in it.
But is it just an artifact of the type of theory we are able to handle, or is that
the way that we do it? It is the theory we have.
Sure.
So certain processes, low energy processes. So what happens is you can get, so if you think of electromagnetism, usually you draw these Feynman diagrams and you could exchange a photon, for example. But this propagator has a 1 over Q squared, where Q is the energy momentum flowing through this. And so the higher energy processes are suppressed. This becomes a bigger number. So that's the way it works in practice. And so when you have, and basically, intuitively, roughly speaking, the lower the value of Q, the longer the distance process it is, or by the uncertainty principle, if you'd like. So in practice, if you want to make something very high energy, you do it with a short distance interaction. And in a supernova, it's pretty hard to make the heaviest particles. Not that I know anything about supernova, but it's just a guess, given. Of course, if you end up with a very high energy photon, some of the time you could make a high energy particle by hitting another high energy particle.
Just a short question. How do you go about calculating cross sections for unstable particles? So something that can decay before it hits the other particle.
Okay, so there's two ways. So if you want to be completely rigorous, then you don't calculate cross sections for unstable particles. You actually make them. So you'd have the stable ones here, and then the subprocess in here would make the unstable one, and that would be the way we do it. And so, you know, inside protons, there's up quarks, down quarks. Those are the stable things. There's also strange quarks, and we treat them as if they were stable. In the final state, we usually treat them as if they're stable, and then subsequently they decay. So you can do it completely right, never have them in the initial or final states. And what happens is, so in a final state, let's say you want to do it right. You could have in a Feynman diagram, you could have a line for an unstable particle. Let's call it U. And then another vertex here for its reappearance into some stable particles. And you could never have it in the final state and do the calculation. But this propagator, since it's 1 over the 4 momentum squared of this, gets very large when it's almost on shell, almost equal to its mass squared. And so it's the same as calculating this and then multiplying by a branching ratio. So that's what we're going to do. In the incoming states, it'll always be up, down quarks, gluons, parts of the proton and the strange quark. But we don't have to talk to it. We'll put them in. In the final state, depending on how long this has lived, we'll usually treat it as if it's a stable particle and then multiply by branching ratios. That's clearly an approximation, but it's a very good approximation. Any other questions? You doing okay? Okay. So let's work in the set. Excuse me. Let's work in this. Let's work in the center of mass frame now, and we're going to have a center of mass energy, E center of mass, which is just EA plus EB. You want to write it in a Lorentz invariant way, so it would be true in any frame. It's just this. And if we go to the center of mass frame, then PA is just EA, and then the momentum. What direction should I take the beam along? It's always the z-axis, right? Is it still called Z in Canada? Jeez. The z-axis, that brings back memories from my youth. I grew up in Toronto. So collision basically looks like what I said. PA, PB, they're coming in, particle A and B, and then one and two go out. Let's say it's two body. This is 1 and 2, and there's some angle. And now if you work all the dot products depend on masses, but they also depend on that angle. So you can't just pull out the m squared from the integral. So how do you do it for a two-body, two-to-two scattering? What do you do? Same as before. We're working in the center of mass frame. So if we're working in the center of mass frame, this sum of momenta is just e, as four momenta, it's just e, oh, center of mass developed another c. It's kind of like your pet frog when it grows a third leg. Did you ever have that happen to you? It's kind of scary.
This quantity equals dps.
Yeah, so here I'm writing out dps. So we're going to get something like this, right, that we have to do. So there's other factors here like the incident flux. The incident flux is easy to work out in the center of mass frame, right? It's 2EA, EB, VA minus VB. Well, let me make it really pathetic. Let me take MA equals MB. So then E is just E. So this ends up being 8PE, if you work it out. Okay. So basically, you can see that because there's a zero here, we've made it look exactly like the decay rate. More or less exactly like the decay rate, right? If I can do exactly the same thing I did before. Yes?
In the delta function, you have PA and PB being four momenta, P1 and P2.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah. I don't know what's wrong with me. I tend to write a lot of wrong things on the board, but just keep fixing it. Okay, so look at when we did a decay rate, this was just PA and it was an M and a zero. All that matters is this sum. It's a something and a zero. So you just do everything like what we did before. All the same trick, the same steps, and you get the answer. So I gotta write it out because time is of the essence. So you end up with d sigma d omega, same type of omega as before. Oh, let me do put one more step. So EA, which comes in, is E center of mass over 2. So now I'll write the final thing. 1 over 64 pi squared E center of mass squared P1 over PA. The invariant matrix element squared. Okay, so those are the key formulas we're going to use a lot. We want to get cross sections and decay rates. We'll have to calculate the m's. That comes from the interactions in the theory. It's a quantum mechanical amplitude. I have to presume that you've taken some field theory. You've done some. You know how to compute the invariant matrix elements. Do you know how to compute the invariant matrix element? I'll do some examples for you too. You know how to get the Feynman rules from a theory when you're with it? Okay, you're good. So how do we get the Feynman rules? We take our Lagrangian, it contains certain quantum fields. We write out those quantum fields. They give us certain amplitudes to create and destroy particles. And basically you have some in-state and some out-state, and you calculate that amplitude. You destroy the particles in the in-state and create them in the out-state. You relate it to certain vacuum expectation values of time order products, and you're good to go. That was kind of fast. So let me remind you of the various structures. What board am I on, class? So you write your Lagrangian out in terms of these fields, quantum fields, and there's various different kinds. We're going to step through very quickly the various different kinds of quantum fields. that'll occur in the theory. If you don't know that, you're toast. You don't want to be toast. Okay, so let's take it. Let's do the simplest example. This is a real, like a fishing reel, a real scalar field. Give me an example of a particle that is represented by a real scalar field in nature. A fundamental particle. The Higgs boson. I think it's actually the only one. Yeah, the Higgs boson, that's a real scalar field. I could call it H, but then there'd be no textbook in the universe that would use that notation. Even aliens living on a planet far, far away, a planet in a galaxy far, far away, use phi for their scalar fields. Those Greeks were powerful. So a scalar field phi of x. This is the usual energy, square root of p squared plus m squared. There's an operator A of p, e to the minus I, p dot x. I called it a real scalar field. So I have to add the Hermitian conjugate, a dagger of p, e to the I, p dot x. These are four vectors dot product. So p dot x is ep time minus p dot x. I'm using the West Coast convention for dot products. It's kind of like the West Coast offense in football. Yeah, that's my only football joke, don't worry. And so what do A and A dagger do? So A dagger creates particles with momentum p. So for example, if I have a one particle state with three momentum p, no spin, it's a scalar, normalized the way I had it before, that's this. And the A satisfies certain commutation relations. So this operator, this quantum mechanical operator, can create and destroy particles of momentum, any momentum p, and it's just summed over all the possible momentum. And what kind of particles do we have in nature? Well, there's scalars. There's fermions, and there's four vectors. There's more, of course. Well, Barton will tell you that maybe there's many more. But we also know there's a graviton. It's got spin 2. It's massless, so it's kind of important. But it's not very important for particle physics. It's got very weak interactions at low energies, so we don't make it in particle accelerators. Or less probability of making it's very small. And so for particle physics, for the standard model, we usually ignore the graviton. But you, as students, should never ignore the graviton. You know why? I'll do an experiment. Came back. It's important. I have a 4-year-old grandson. We have a globe at home. So we were looking at the globe. There's the equator. And he says, Grandpa, why don't the people down here fall off? Good question, actually. So gravity is very important for large-scale structure, for our lives, but it's not the subject of this class. So we're not going to talk about spin 2 fields. So let me quickly, in the remaining few minutes, step through the various types of fields we have. And then next lecture, I'll step through quickly the calculation of one cross-section, and we'll start with the standard model. Sorry to take so long on this, but chalk dust in the lungs, it's one of the hazards of this profession. That's why I get danger pay. It's not quite as dangerous as being a coal miner. Get white lung disease instead of black lung disease, but anyways. Okay, let's just go through the types of fields, because you got to know that. We got to know what they do, basically. So when I write down a Lagrangian. So there's Dirac fermions. Same idea. There's always the d3p, 2 pi cubed, root of 2 ep. And then there's just other stuff. So here they have spin. There's spin a half. People know about Meyer, about using Weyl and Dirac fields, or you just know Dirac convention.
We briefly looked at the different spin of that.
Pardon?
We briefly looked at the different spin of representation.
But did you mostly use the four component notation in what you did? Mostly the four component. Okay, so this is the four component. I called it Dirac, but it's its usual four component one. And what's different from the scalar case is you get something with four components here. There's a label that's the spin. So this is like the spin wave function. In non-relativistic quantum mechanics, there's a Pauli spinner. This is, but here it's a four-component object, because this field will actually represent many things, electrons, anti-electrons. So there's more components. And also we're doing relativistic quantum mechanics. E to the minus I p dot x. And then there's another thing. It's not the same thing, because this is not a real field. Psi dagger is different than psi. And a different four-component object. And basically, so what fermion do you want to look at? I can't keep saying fermion, anti-fermion. Let's pretend it's the electron. So this would destroy electrons of spin S, and A dagger would create them. And B destroys positrons, the anti-electron, with spin S, and B dagger creates them. So psi destroys an electron and creates a positron. If you see a psi in a Lagrangian, you want to think, what can it do physically? That's what it can do. And it can destroy and create them with any momentum because it's integrated D3P here. This field is a function of x. Yes?
Notation question. On the B, you have B plus minus.
This is a dagger, Hermitian conjugate.
Okay. And the minus?
Is there a minus?
No, that's from.
Is that from a previous?
From a previous.
Okay.
Oh, I see. Sorry. Cool. I like that.
If A has the spin label,
B also has a spin label. Thank you. So it's kind of more complicated, right? You've got to keep track of the spin label. If you have a quantum mechanical amplitude, and it's got a certain number of particles going into another certain number of particles, there'll be one of these spinners. It'll be linear in the spinners for each of the appropriate particles. U's for particles, V's for antiparticles. So when you think of a Lorentz invariant amplitude and what it can be made of, it'll always have the requisite number of spinners for each of the particles in the external states, and then the momenta. And it's linear in these factors. And that's how you make up the amplitude. What else do I have to consider? Let me do one more. So there's complex scalar fields. I'm not going to do four vectors. You just do it by analogy. So complex scalar fields. Uh-oh. I said I'd let you out on time. I learned this as a really early that, you know, when you give a lecture, the crowd is always happy if they're let out on time. Complex scalar. Well, we can copy it here. What happens? What changes? So what's an example in nature of a complex, what particle would be represented by a complex scalar field? You probably don't know. So you saw for the electron, there was electrons and positrons. For, you know, for scalars, there's particles and antiparticles too. For example, there's the charge pion, pi plus, and its antiparticle has the opposite charge, the pi minus. And it has spin zero, so it's represented by a scalar field. So there's no four vectors, so what do you do here? But you copy what you did there. You just make this a BP dagger, and this would destroy the pi plus, and B dagger would create the pi minus. So there's charge, there's scalar fields that are complex as well in the case where you have scalars that are where they're not their own antiparticle. The Higgs is its own antiparticle, so we have a real scalar field. Okay, so what am I going to do next time? I'm going to go over very quickly the calculation of one invariant matrix element because it will be important later on when we do strong interactions. So I'm going to calculate or sketch the calculation. You've probably already done it. E plus, I won't give every step, don't worry. But I'll think of enough, so if you haven't seen it, you'd be okay. Of E plus E minus to mu plus mu minus, How do I get the M? And then we'll convert it to a cross-section. It's a very famous cross-section. It played a big role in understanding why the strong interactions become weak at high energies. Of course, nothing in here involves strong interactions. It's all electrodynamics. But when the strong interactions become weak, they tend to behave like electrodynamics. So it seems like a simple, old-fashioned thing, but it'll play an important role in something that's kind of old, but at least a little more modern than this. And then we'll go on to step through the standard model at tree level. What are the interactions? What do they do? It's got a beautiful structure, the standard model at tree level. It fits like a glove. Every time I say that, I think about the OJ trial. I just can't help it. I try not to, but every time I say that, if you don't know about this, ask someone that does. Anyway, so it really fits together like a glove, but it's not pretty. It just was, before it was confirmed it was right, there was a nicer model called the Georgi-Glashow model for the weak interactions that was a lot more elegant, but it just wasn't nature. But it does fit together, and whenever we try to do something that's beyond the standard model, the candle, the measure you should use to see how much you've improved things is how it looks compared to the standard model. Not as far as elegance goes, but how it fits together. How much you have to say to make it agree with experiment. It ends up for the standard model, you have to say very little. And we'll step through that, we'll understand that. It'll be the highlight of your life, I promise you. See you tomorrow, 9 a.m.